one time, can we take a change more time?
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to speak to him.
Good morning, Rabbi Sai.
Thank you.
So, continuing from yesterday, our story of what happened to Rabbi Yehuda ben Bova. Rabbi Yehuda ben Bova in Roman times wanted to prolong the inyan of Smicho, which we heard about last week from Rabbi Shtal, because last week's parasha Pinchos was when Moshe Rabbeinu gave over Menasata Mehoidecho Olof. Moshe Rabbeinu was Soimech, Vesomach. He was Soimech Yehoshua, and he started a chain of tradition that moved down through the generations. Unfortunately, we don't have that smicha of Ish Mipi Ish from Moshe Rabbeinu Bizman Hazeh. Our smicha is just a heta eroh, permission from a rabbi to another rabbi, authority to Paskin Shalas. But at the time, you needed smicha in order to be a member of a Sanhedrin, in order to be a member of a Sanhedrin of 71 or Sanhedrin of Chof Gimel, in order to fix Chodoshim, in order to fix Yomim Toivim, in order to administer Dine Knossos and punishments, etc. So, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava was worried that this was being lost, and therefore against the law of the Romans, he decided that he was going to give smicha to five. It doesn't say they were Talmidim, Faket. It says as follows. He went out into the countryside, and he went to a place which was equidistant, but a long way from two towns. Because the Roman Gezeira was that if anybody is found caught doing smicha, not only would he be executed, but the whole of the town would be wiped out. So therefore it says that Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, what did he do? Holach v'yoshav loy ben shnei horim gedoylim. He went to a valley between two mountains, uvein shtei ayoros gedoylos, and a long way from the nearest city, uvein shnei tchumei shabos, uvein usha l'shaforum, somewhere between a place called Usha and another place called Shaforum. In other words, that if he was going to get caught, they would not be able to associate him with any other dwelling, with any other place of dwelling, like a village or a town or a city, and therefore nobody would be punished on his account for giving smicha, that they wouldn't be able to associate him with a particular town. And then the somach shom chamisha zakenim, whatever smicha means, and I don't know exactly what the smicha was, I presume there was a physical placing of the hands on the head or something like that, but the idea was that Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava passed on the inyan of smicha mimei Moshe Rabbeinu to these talmidim. Ve'elahein, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yosi, Rabbi Loza ben Shamua. So you've got five talmidim, they're not talmidim, Chamisha Zakenim, who now received smicha, and they're continuing the chain of smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu. And Rabbi Avia says, after Rabbi Nehemiah, that there were six, and there was Rabbi Nehemiah as well. Fine. Kivin shekira ve'en bohem. But the Romans found out, and they came after them. They sent a group of soldiers in order to catch them. Yeah, Omar Lahem, he said to them, they saw the Romans coming, and they said, Bonai, Rutsu, my children, run for your lives. Omar Loi, they said to him, Oberebi, Mate Olecho, what about you? We can't leave you. And he said, Omar Lahem, he said, Hareini mutal lifteim ke'even she'ein lohoifchim. I don't have the koyach. Maybe he was very elderly, maybe he wasn't very fit. He said, I can't run. He said, you go and save your lives and leave me. Omru, they said, lo izozu mishom ache noatsu boy shloish meyos lun biois shel barzel vaso kekivro. Yeah. That unfortunately he got caught and they threw. It says 300 javelins, 300 spears they threw at him, and they pierced him so many times that he was like a sieve. That's what it says. So according to this Gemara, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, this is the Gemara on Sanhedrin, Daf, Yud Gimel on the base, Yud Dalet on the Aleph. But according to this Gemara, yeah, it would appear that Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava was killed outside in a mountain when he was doing smicha, by the soldiers who caught him, and they. So now we've got three versions of what happened to Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. We've got one version, which is in Adir in Azeh Alavona, which is on Yom Kippur, which just simply says that he was a chosid and that he was 70 years old and that they killed him. And that could have happened, yeah, in the palace, in the governor's residence, or wherever it was that they were executing the Asorah Haruge Malchus. Then we had the second one, which is a whole story about, again, could have happened in the palace, but the whole story about being Erev Shabbos and him asking for permission to make Kiddush. Yeah, and then and when he got to Asher Bora Elohim La'asois, that's when they executed him. Well, there's two versions of that story which could have taken place in front of, as one of the Asorah Haruge Malchus. According to Ela Eskerel, they were all brought in front of this Roman general or Roman governor in one place. But now you've got the same Rabbi Huda ben Bova, who according to the Gemara is being killed outside, in long way from any town, in the outside, in the middle of giving a smicha. He got caught by a group of Roman soldiers. Now just, is our speaker here? Not yet. Okay, let's try for another minute. Just to complicate it further. So we've got three versions of Rabbi Yehuda ben Bova, and obviously they can't all be exactly historically correct. Then we have another issue, and that is that in the Adiria Halvonon, Arze Halvonon, Adiria HaToyra, that we say on Yom, not Yom Kippur, we will say on Tisha B'Av, if Moshiach hasn't come by then, it says as follows. Now, bear in mind that Rabbi Elozar ben Shamua was one of the Talmidim of one of the Zakenim who got smicha now from Rabbi Yehuda ben Bova. And Rabbi Elozar ben Shamua was also one of the Asorah Haruge Malchus. And because the speaker is here, I will speak tomorrow about Rabbi Elozar ben Shamua and how the story in the Adira Arze Alvon and Adira Atoria that we say on Tisha B'Av will contradict all the above. So, Belineda will speak about that tomorrow.
Started at 2 in Northwest London, Thursday, Kaftal at Tammuz, 9th of July. Rabbi Rashi Simon, Shlita of Kesher, Parsha with a vowel factor. The Sikhtarib is sponsored. Lim Nishmas, Morris Gitka, Delang, Alea Sholabas, Hechova, Ramodachai, Zchorin Lebrocha, whose Yatai was Sandor Nishmas, our esteemed founder, Yosef Dov, Ben Roshimachol Tzvi Itzkovitz.
Thank you very much. Good morning to everyone. Morning. We read this week Parshas Matos Maaseh. Of course, you know that. It's the longest sedra yet discovered. It's a double sedra. We normally do read them together. The subjects that appear in Matos Maaseh are several can be summarized. I'm not planning to summarize them, but what I'm trying to get at is that the well-known opening passage is all about Nedarim. And its position here at the end, or near the end of Bamidbar, it's not immediately obvious. Mefarshim struggled to explain why it's exactly here. Also, the Torah writes in a lot of detail, kind of in a almost prolix manner about the different possibilities, girl who is married or who's not married or who gets married, a man who makes a neder, a woman makes a neder. So there's a lot here, and the Mefarshim, as I said, are interested initially in its position. And I want to share with you an approach that I saw years ago in the Tzvar Hamor. At Tzvar Hamor was Rabbi Avraham Saba. It's published modern times in two volumes like this. He was among the Spanish exiles, and he, together with many of his contemporaries, were driven from Spain in 1492, and he hit the road and he just went west to Portugal. He lived in Portugal for about 5 years, and okay, I don't want to dwell on the background, although it's a fascinating biographical sketch. I was just hearing from my uncle about the Elozar ben Shamua. So the human aspect of these great personalities I find often very captivating. It gives one a deeper appreciation of the individual behind the Torah thoughts. But we'll have to say that for another occasion. Why is the Parsha here of Nedarim positioned immediately after Parshas Pinchas? So Parshas Pinchas is also a very eventful Parsha. And the whole latter portion of Parshas Pinchas is taken up with the Karbanos of the various Moadim in the course of the year. Collectively, the preceding parsha is about the celebration of various special occasions in the course of the year. I mean, maybe Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is not exactly a celebration. The other Moadim are. Shabbos is mentioned there as well. Obviously, the Korban Tamid is mentioned also. But the last part of Parshas Pinchas deals with the Korbanos day by day on Sukkos and then Shmini Atzeres. Says it Tzor Hamor, these are times of joy. These are times of celebration. These are times of exaltation. These are times of appreciation, especially Chag HaAsif, which is the late harvest, when we celebrate the bountiful yield and we are looking forward with confidence to the winter months ahead, and the warehouses are brimming with provision. So there's a natural feeling of joy, of gratitude, and of celebration. Says at Tzor Hamor, that kind of background, that context, has a risk factor to it. The risk is excessive indulgence. The risk is for a person to value or somehow delight or exalt in the bounty, in the plenty, in the material blessing, and this does not always bring out the best in a person. It's like the bankers who get their bonuses in December, and they're flush with cash, and then they go traveling, and they get into all kinds of mischief along the way. It says that Tzor Hamor, this is why, immediately after that parsha, we have Parshas Nedarim. A person should have the sensitivity to realize when he is vulnerable, when his indulgence and his celebration can lead him in an unfortunate direction. Like it says, Tzadikim Mashbim Es Yitzram, that the righteous take a Shavua in order to rein in their desires, or, as I say, to serve as a corrective to the feeling of excessive joy and celebration and excessive indulgence. Tzor Hamor says, I'll just read a few lines of it. The Malach Kosev Inyan Hamoadim Kulam V'chassam B'chak HaSukkos Sheyesh Bo Simcha Yeseira. Sukkos is the time of our joy. Mikol Hamoados L'fishu Chag HaAsif. He says, V'yadu Ki Mitoch HaSimcha V'ha'achila Adam To'eh. As a result of the joy and the indulgence, the eating, the drinking, it hasn't even mentioned the drinking, Adam Toa, a person can err. It's putting it gently. The Vishi Yitzum is Gaber Alav, because his Yitzahara overwhelms him. It's mentioned in Eov like that as well, the beginning of Eov, if you remember. Achil Zehatam HaChachame HaRishonim HaYomishabrim Kleis Chuchis Yafim Besudos Kadeshis Atzvu HaNashim V'yuros Hashem. So the early Tzadikim, when there was a party that was getting out of hand, so they would break something of value in order to inject a note of caution, a note of balance. And this, according to the Tosus, is the source of breaking a glass under the chuppah. Even though we say it's a Zeche Yerushalayim, but it seems the original source is exactly this. It's in order to offset the excessive joy or the danger of excessive joy and excessive indulgence. So in that same vein, says the Tzor Hamor, this is why we have the Parsha of Nedarim over here. He gives another interesting example. There's a bracha that we are familiar with. We don't say it that often, and perhaps you do. Hatova Hametiv. So the occasion for that bracha is discussed in the Gemara Brachos in a few different ways. The classic occasion of the bracha Tova Meitiv is when you are drinking wine, enjoying wine, and then they bring to the table better wine. That's the classic example of Tova Meitiv. There are other times when we say that bracha as well. So says the Tzor Hamor an interesting thing. He says, "Mizatam atzmo tiknu bishinu hayayin hatov hameti." When you have wine, and then you have even better wine, then you make a special bracha. The one who is good and who does good. It's like you're feeling the divine beneficence to such an extent you want to make a new bracha. And the Chachamim formulated such a bracha. Why is it a bracha only on wine? So he says that there's another context of that bracha hatov hametiv. I said we don't say the bracha very often, but actually, in a certain way, we do. We say it every time we have Birkas HaMazon, because there is a fourth bracha that the Chachamim added on, the bracha HaTova HaMeitiv, Hu Eitiv Lanu. So the Gemara says that that bracha, ironically, was formulated as a result of the kavura of the Haruge Beta. I don't want to dwell on sad things, although it is that time of the year. The Talmud relates how the massacre at Beitar was of enormous proportions. There has to be some hyperbole in the way the Talmud describes it, perhaps not for me to say, but you know, the description of the massacre and the blood is very almost overwhelming. But it's clear that this was a tragic defeat through the hands of the Romans at the time of the Bar Kokhba uprising. Was probably the last gasp of Bar Kokhba's ill-fated uprising, and it was a terrible tragedy. But eventually there was a certain ray of light, in that those who were killed in this massacre eventually were buried. And even that didn't happen right away, and therefore the rabbis formulated this bracha HaTova HaMeitiv. It's Hatov, it's good that their bodies were preserved despite lying on the open field for however many months. V'hametiv, et zachol l'kvura. Very ironic. I mean, Hatov hametiv, we say, is a very upbeat bracha. I mean, Hatov v'hametiv, what could be better? Like somebody once said, you can understand the bracha in terms of wine, who makes the good and the better. And yet, the Chachamim formulated for this. So the Tzra Hamor suggests that that's exactly the point. When a person is drinking wine and he's enjoying the wine, and then they bring in more wine, better wine, he's going to drink the better wine as well. What happens if they bring better wine after that? He'll drink that too. So therefore they formulated the bracha HaTov HaMeitiv in order to also evoke the memory of the tragedy of Beitar. This is a similar idea, he maintains, to inject a note of balance or something to offset the exuberance and the joy. He makes another interesting point. I don't know if you are aware, but I was not aware previously until I learned this, that the Ravid is of the view that on Shinui Pas, you should also say Hatov HaMeitiv. If you're eating, whole wheat bread from Carmelis, and then they bring you in artisanal bread from, bread or wherever is the best place around here, it's not for me to say, it's a matter of taste, I'm sure, that if you have bread, which is basic bread, and then they bring in better bread, according to the rabbi, they also say, Hatov HaMeitiv. If you say it for wine, you should say it for bread. But we don't paskin that way. And the Tzra Hamor says, the point is that bread, ki al alechem yichya hadam, bread is something essential. There's no grounds to criticize a person for eating bread. What else should he eat? I mean, your nutritionist might say too many carbs, that sort of thing. But in the earlier times, they weren't worried about that. Bread is bread, you know. A person needs to eat bread. There's nothing indulgence per se in eating bread. So therefore, they didn't make a takana for a bracha on superior bread, because the bracha is only in consuming something which has a risk factor, something which inherently carries within it the possibility of overindulgence, the possibility of breakdown of discipline. That's when they said, HaBracha HaTov HaMeitiv. So his chidush is, the Bracha HaTov HaMeitiv is deliberately formulated to also recall the Haruge Beitar in order to introduce that balance. And he says this is the whole idea of Nedarim, and this is why we have this Parsha over here as well, immediately after the Karbonas, and especially regarding Sukkos in particular. I'll just read you a few more lines. The fish yadush ayayin boged uznus yayin v'tiroshi kachlev. Wine leads to promiscuity, breakdown of discipline. The fish yabesimcha hayayin yitzferu b'nei adam latzas nachash hanachoshes. So he goes back to the, I think he's alluding here to the original instance of the downfall of man with the nachash and with the Eitz Hadas, which he's evidently alluding to the possibility that Eitz Hadas was a grapevine, subject to different opinions. Ki b'chol makom sheyesh bo shinui hayayin, sheyesh bo ribui simcha, Shemru Hatov Ametiv. That's why we say that bracha, Hatov Ametiv. And he brings here, the editor brings in a nice footnote here. He says this idea about the function of a neder to restrain a person's natural fondness for pleasure, for gratification, for indulgence. So he says, V'chein tzorech l'chol adam lasos lishmor nafsho me'as simchos. A person has to approach celebration with moderation, with caution. Ka'omro tov leches el beis avel, like it says in Koheles, better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of celebration, to a wedding, it means. V'shiyetzelev adam rami nu'urav v'ulay lo yil kol zeh. And he says that we have an example of Boaz. So Boaz was a great person, ultimately the progenitor of David HaMelech, as we know, through his ironic association with this Moabite woman who had been married to a relative of his, as we well know. So the Medrash says, Chai Hashem shichvi ad haboker. So Boaz saw this young woman lying at his feet unexpectedly, and the circumstances were such that one can understand that this was something was a surprise for him, and maybe offered some temptation. So he said, "Chai Hashem shichvi ad haboker, stay here till the morning." Varmachachamim, the expression "Chai Hashem" is a term associated with a neder. So the Chachamim say, "Lemin nishba?" To whom did he take this oath? Chai Hashem. Who was he addressing? Liyitzo nishba. He was addressing his own yetzara. He felt the temptation. He felt the lure, the attraction of the occasion. And remember that he had been threshing. That means to say that it was the celebration. Celebration was the time of the harvest. It was a time, like a person does a business deal and he gets the payoff. It's worked very hard for it, long awaited, always some anxiety. Will it actually happen? He gets the ping on his phone and he says, my account has been credited with this amount. He feels great at that moment. Boaz was like that. It was a time when he had harvested the crop and he was feeling very good. Yeah, and he saw, look at that, a bonus. He's got a girl at his feet as well. Liyitzo nishba. Quotes here the Medrash. Shalosh hein sheyitzran takfan aleihem v'nishba ulo. There were three people whose yetzahara was assailing them. And they took a neder, or nishba, shivu, in this instance, to counteract it. One of them is Boaz Minayin. His Yetzirah was very wily and very persistent. And the Yetzirah said to him, Amarle ata panui vihi panuya. You're unattached, she's unattached. You're looking for a wife. Vihi mevakesh esish. And she's looking for a husband. Good opportunity. Miyad nishba le Yetzirah chai Hashem. Immediately he took that vow. Because even though the urging of the Yetzara was a very potent force, but he realized this is not right. This is to succumb to the blandishments of the Yetzara would be to compromise his own morality. So he took the Shvua in order to counteract that. And it says Nedarim Shagla Prishus, the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos as well. The Chaim. Therefore, after the joy, we have the matter of Nedarim that follows immediately. He doesn't bring it here in the notes. I can tell you the Rev, it's Veikarab Chaf Gimel Yud Aleph. He only brings one from Boaz. I guess the one from Boaz is the most compelling. I was also wondering who the other joy. I didn't have a chance to look it up. The Rambam also in Hilchas Nedarim mentions something similar as well, that even though the whole subject of Nedarim is a bit equivocal, whether it's praiseworthy or blameworthy, whether a person should, let's say, embrace the habit of Nedarim or better to avoid Nedarim. We have the Pasuk Tov Shelo Tidor Mishetidor V'lo Tishalem. It's better not to take a neder than to take the neder and to fail to fulfill the neder. I mean, that's setting a pretty low bar. I mean, it's obvious to take a neder and then to violate the neder is obviously something wrong. But the whole idea is, according to this perspective, that the whole institution of a neder is to counteract the yitzhara. So it's almost like the nazir, who in a way is the paradigm for one who takes a neder. That to be a nazir, is it blameworthy or is it praiseworthy? So this is very well known. The Gemara discusses that. And the Rambam puts the whole subject of Nedarim in that context as well. The Zeruze Nafshei, if a person needs it to prompt himself, to motivate himself, or maybe to rein in his own excesses, then it's something praiseworthy. But we don't find that it's something which a person should undertake, you know, habitually as a matter of course. The interesting question is, can a person find himself bound by a neder accidentally or inadvertently? So we know about the institution of Hataras Nedarim, which we do as a kind of convention on Erev Rosh Hashanah. It probably is effective. It's more effective if you specify a neder that you've actually taken. As we know, it applies also to a habit, something which is praiseworthy, which a person does without saying bli neder. And this is an important principle as well. Question is, what if a person actually does undertake to do something? He doesn't articulate it as a vow, but it is something to which he commits himself in his own mind. So does that have the status of a neder? And actually, we're all, I'll say all, but many of us are prone to that. You know, a person wants to exercise regularly. So he says, you know what, I'm going to walk half an hour a day. Or whatever he undertakes. Or I realize that I'm eating too much cholesterol, so I'm going to do without, whatever it may be. And those kinds of commitments sometimes are difficult to uphold. So I want to just tell you a story about something happened to me many years ago, about someone who, when we lived in Little Venice back in the day, long time ago, so I used to run a beginner service at a local shul. Every Shabbos morning, we had a special beginner service that took place approximately during the same time as the normal tefillah. And on another occasion, I'll tell you a lot about it. That's a lot to be said, but that's not the subject for now. There was someone who used to come to that beginner service. A Jewish boy, I'm sure he must have had a bar mitzvah, but he hadn't been much involved in Jewish life for a long time. And he began to come to that beginner service, and he began to enjoy it, and began to learn more about tefillah, and about Hashem, and about the Jewish people, and his role within the Jewish people. So one time I invited him home for lunch, Shabbos lunch. So on the way home, he said, yeah, I'd love to come. On the way home, he says, Rabbi Simon, do you know what your wife is planning to serve for lunch? I said, I don't really monitor these things. I said, when Ruth and I got married, we agreed on an equal division of labor in the kitchen. She's responsible for making the food. I'm in charge of eating the food. And it's worked very well for all these years. So I said, why do you ask? So he said, well, I am a vegetarian. So I said to him, well, I'm sure there'll be something for you to eat. And obviously, it hadn't been planned in advance. I only invited him on the spot. Ruthie didn't even know he was coming home. I said, I'm sure you'll find something to eat. So he said, well, actually, I don't really want to be a vegetarian. So I said, you're confusing me. Are you a vegetarian? I said, if you want to be a vegetarian so you can eat meat, then how can I help? So he explained to me, though, something more subtle. And actually, I think very interesting and very insightful. He said that I decided to become a vegetarian a few years ago because I didn't want to lead my life just with abandon, to eat whatever comes my way. I thought, as a human being, I should have greater sensitivity to the world around me, and I should not just seize on whatever food is available, and I'm going to become a vegetarian. I'm not going to eat any more meat. I said, okay. He said, the thing is, though, that actually I've decided I don't really want to be a vegetarian anymore. I said, why not? So here's the interesting thing. He said, Because a few years ago, when I decided to be vegetarian, when I look back on it, I realized that the reason is that I felt my life doesn't have enough parameters. I don't have any restrictions. I'm leading my life in a kind of like amoral fashion without any value structure. I just, you know, do whatever I do as long as it's not illegal or immoral. And I think I felt there has to be more. My soul was kind of urging me to lead my life in a more refined manner. But now that I've begun to learn about Judaism, I've begun to learn about Torah, I've begun to learn about the laws, about Shabbos, and about prayer, and about the kosher laws, I realize I don't need that vegetarian business. I have something much more authentic. I have discovered something which is much more nourishing for my soul than just doing without steak or without chicken soup. And he said, and that's why, now that you invited me to your home for Shabbos, I'm thinking to myself, what kind of wonderful food will there be there? Kosher food, Shabbos food, that is what will nourish me and nourish my soul. I don't want to be a vegetarian anymore. So I thought that was very interesting. I said, the problem is that if you really undertook to be a vegetarian, I'm not sure that it's right for you to just jettison it and start eating meat. I said, I think we need to do Hataras Nedarim. So the thing is, we don't like to do that on Shabbos so much. On Tzorch Shabbos, actually, you can. Problem is, ich bin nicht der Mumche l'Rabim, so I need three. I didn't have three. I had myself and him. My kids were young. We may have another guest, but you know, I don't think it was suitable to be a dayan, even as a hedyot. I said, come back tomorrow, because on Sundays I used to give a Gemara shir. I had a few guys who came to the shir. I said, we'll convene a little ad hoc rabbinic court, and we can release you from your vegetarian commitment. So that actually was...
What did he have for lunch?
I can't remember what he had for lunch, actually. But I remember saying to him that in all the years, I said, no one has ever gone away from Ruthie's Shabbos table hungry. I don't think you'll be the first. So he was living, at that time we were living in Medovea, he was living in that area, but subsequently he moved to Golders Green, he opened a steakhouse. No, he didn't open a steakhouse. No, it's not true. He did get married, he did move to Golders Green, he does live in Golders Green, he didn't open the steakhouse. Though. But whenever, let's go back about 30 years, but whenever I see him from time to time, I remind him of that, of his former vegetarian days. Those days are long, long behind him now. But no, he's a fine fellow. He's got children and grandchildren now as well. So this was my practical introduction to Hilchos Nedarim. But the insight which I want to leave you with is a recognition that there can be something sublime about the impulse to take a neder when a person feels, I can do better. The way I live my life is too much with abandon, and I want to urge myself, prompt myself, maybe even mechay myself to do better. Having said that, there is also a mechanism of Hatar Sadarim, which is a possibility as well. But it's interesting, this fellow was what we call maybe a koshertarian, really, as well. But he says a vegetarian, but what he really wanted to do was keep kosher, and now he does, so may we all learn to grow and to be the best people we can be. Thank you very much. Wish you good time.
Very nice. Thank you.